So we're working our way through Exodus, and I did something I don't like to do. I don't like to stop in the middle of a particular thought, but last time we started into the Ten Commandments and didn't get through all of those. But I'm sort of guessing you've spent some time with the Ten Commandments in your life before, so this isn't brand new material we're breaking into. But to review, last time we talked about the approach to Mount Sinai. We met Moses' father-in-law, or at least his relative by marriage, who suggested what we call the pyramidal structure or the captain's system, which, although it never says specifically that God endorsed it, it seems that he did. You know, Jethro even said, if you do this and if God, you know, blesses you, or if God tells you so, you know, then you'll do well. That's where I say I think God probably did tell him so. So they set that up, and it worked pretty well. We've already started with manna, water from the rock, all these great stories that we've heard about. And then perhaps one of the greatest of all, of course, God warns them to get ready. You know, 3 days to make sure you're pure, cordon off the mountain, nobody come up here because it's going to be holy. And then God, you know, descends on the mountain, thunder and lightning and earthquake, and he begins speaking the Ten Commandments. I've got a note here, something I wanted to say, but I'll pick that up later. Okay, and we went through the first few. We started with, of course, you shall have no other gods before me. We summarize that just saying no idolatry, but you could expand that, you know, greatly. Matter of fact, it occurs to me, I think it's a year or so ago, that the men doing the Beyond Today with the Bible study series, they spent a Bible study on each of these commandments, so devoted a whole hour to exploring each one. And we're not spending that kind of time here, but it's good to realize that we could. So, of course, no other gods, and then also no graven images. Don't make something to look like God or even to represent him. That's one of the things I didn't spend as much time on that, but we hold to that even in the idea of we don't like to have paintings that we say, well, this is Jesus. You know, a lot of people have done that, and they say, well, it's not violating the principle of the law because we're not worshiping it. But still, to me, if you say this is him, it implies that you're going to have that veneration. And I know my wife's been involved in creating the youth lessons for the feast. And, of course, she doesn't draw, so we get someone else to do it. But there's sometimes the issue, well, do you portray Jesus? Do you portray part of him? Can you do him from the back? Can you have just his hands? And one thing I've learned is somebody's going to be bothered by even a little bit. So we've basically taken the strategy of saying, no, we're not even going to go anywhere near there. So we don't say how close is too close to the line. So anyway, yeah, Charlie?
The Beyond Today magazine, they're showing his feet walking up some stairs. Is that okay with just sandals on? It was a Beyond Today magazine.
It doesn't bother me. Like I said, sometimes there are people that will take offense at that. So, yeah, because feet are feet. I'm sure Jesus' feet look, well, maybe his mom could tell him apart from other people's feet, but most people wouldn't have. So, I don't know, it's just, there are certain, you could almost say editorial decisions, but the basis of this is don't make any image of anything that you're going to worship, and don't try to represent God by any of these things. We'll see that come out in the first incident when Moses comes back down off the mountain, but we got to get him up there first. We cover don't take God's name in vain. We discuss not using the name lightly, not any of his titles we don't take lightly. And I think somebody brought up the idea of euphemisms, and I'm one of those that I think, yeah, it's better to avoid euphemisms if it still represents that. So let's move on to verse 8, get into the Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. I like that if it says keep it holy. You know, we don't make it holy. It had already been holy. It existed from creation. So this one isn't establishing it new. It's saying remember it. 6 days you shall labor to do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, or the strangers in your gates. And there's a reminder why. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them and rested the seventh. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. It reminds us again, God is the one that made that holy time. And it's not something that we can change. You know, we have the pointing back to creation. If you remember in practical Christianity when we were talking about keeping the Sabbath somewhat, I mentioned that we could look to Hebrews chapter 4, and it's explained there, not as straightforward as this, but it indicates that the Sabbath also is a symbolic of and memorializes the millennium to come. So the Sabbath pictures both of those things. And the future fulfillment is a very big reason we can say we still keep the Sabbath. Now, that's not to say if it didn't have that, we wouldn't. I'm not implying that, but there is something yet unfulfilled that it represents that's a very powerful reason that we need it. And I'll make the reference, of course, Isaiah 58 gives us more guidance. Here it simply says, don't work. And again, in practical Christianity, we discuss that there's a lot of decisions and analysis going into what is work and what isn't work, and what more does God want. So I'm not going to go into all that here. I will mention, and this kind of surprised me, although it makes kind of sense, you know, studying American history, I spent a lot of time reading things by and about the Puritans, and I learned that they, among other Christian churches, see in this command not only a command to rest on the seventh day, but it does seem to be a directive to work on the other 6 days. And some have taken that to be very literal, like you work 6 days a week, you know, you be diligent. I'm not sure that means never take any of those days off, otherwise we'd all be in trouble. But I don't know, it seems in modern society there's more danger of never taking any time off to rest. I know Sundays I'm often more tired by the end of than I am on weekdays. But it's worth you knowing that. There are some who have made that a spiritual principle that we are directed to work on other days besides the Sabbath. Of course, there is a lot of direction about other people. Don't have others work under your employment or under your direction. Don't get others to work for you. But one thing I find interesting, and I don't want to go into the discussion of, you know, because some people say, well, if I stop at a gas station, if someone working for me, if I go into a restaurant, if, you know, lots of things like that. I've heard very good arguments on both sides. And as I said, if we let ourselves go there, we could spend the whole next 2 hours discussing it and might not reach a resolution. Not to say that it's not worthy of that, but not in this particular class. One thing that comes into play I find interesting, it says, the command is that you shall do no work, nor your son, your daughter, your male servant. It doesn't talk about someone else's servant that you don't have control over. You know, I'm not going to go out there and, you know, be like a terrorist and shut down the factories that are working on the Sabbath. It's not my place to do that. But if someone's under my control, I'm going to make sure I don't have them work. And I'm not saying that's the end of the argument or the discussion. I'd rather say discussion than argument, because argument implies, you know, vehemence and disagreement. So it's just a factor to throw in there. Next command, number 5. They get shorter from here on in. Number 12, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Honor implies respect. It implies obedience. Something that Jesus Christ expounded in the Gospels implies a bit more. In Mark 7, verses 10 through 13, Jesus Christ makes a reference to providing physical support, implying aged parents who they might rely on their children to support them. And Jesus said, you know, he was criticizing the Pharisees for having this practice of declaring something Corban that is dedicated to the temple. He said, you do that instead of helping your parents. Therefore, this custom is preventing you from honoring your father and your mother. And the roundabout thing I'm getting to is, so honoring them includes not only respect and obedience, but providing for when the situation calls for it. What did the Apostle Paul say about this commandment? Anybody remember? He called it
first commandment with promise?
Yes, Ephesians 6, verses 1 through 3, the first commandment with promise. And what's the promise here? Oh, that your days may be long upon the land. My grandmother liked to cite this. I told you my grandmother lived to be 95 years old, and she talked about how much she loved her mother, and in her mind she put those two together. They might have gone together. I think it's interesting, another promise is added when the commandments are reiterated in Deuteronomy chapter 5. In Deuteronomy 5 and verse 16, it says, honor your father and mother that it will be well with you. So not only long life, but we see later a promise that it be well with you. Which is good, because living long when you're not well isn't so much fun. Hannah? Mark 7, verses 10 through 13 was the reference to Christ where he was discussing that with the Pharisees. Okay, so we understand this pretty clearly. As I said, now they get really short. Number 13, or verse 13, command number 6, do not murder. I like the New King James says the word murder rather than thou shalt not kill as the Old King James does, because this is not a prohibition against any killing. Killing of animals is obviously something that's commanded in certain times. But this is a command against what we would call unlawful taking of human life. Okay, so don't unlawfully take someone else's life. And we would make the case that God would give human governments the authority to impose capital punishment, but we don't see that bestowed on individuals. I'll make another reference to something Christ taught in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, Matthew 5 verses 27 and 28, where he's discussing what we sometimes call the spirit of the law. He says, you know, you're told not to murder, but I say, you know, don't even hate your brother without cause. So, you know, having hate in your heart, Christ equates to murder because it could lead to that. So that's not what God spoke from the Ten Commandments, but it's, you know, we want to go well beyond this letter of the law. Okay, moving on to the seventh command in verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. No adultery. A broad way of looking at that is no sex outside of marriage. I've heard some say that this includes sex before marriage, which is defined as fornication, making the division. Although I've also seen some Hebrew scholars that say, no, there's different words, and this doesn't necessarily include that. But I would say the spirit of the law would encompass it. And matter of fact, back again in Matthew 25, in that same passage, Matthew 5, verses 27 to 28, basically he says, the spirit behind this is that you shouldn't have lust for another person. So, rather than restrict it, saying, okay, this is bad, but this isn't breaking the Ten Commandments, Christ is saying, look, you've just as well as done it if you have those thoughts in your mind and in your heart. Going on, the eighth commandment in verse 15, you shall not steal. Okay, don't steal. Pretty simple. God doesn't make a difference between petty larceny and grand larceny. And he doesn't say it's okay to steal a candy bar, just don't go steal a car. You know, so armed robbery is bad, shoplifting is bad. All of that's forbidden. Which goes to support something I mentioned in one of the classes yesterday, the idea that ownership of private property is something that God seems to have established and supports. And I'm not saying that he's making a political statement that he's for capitalism and against socialism, but he believes in people owning their stuff, and you shouldn't take someone's stuff, which I always like using the word stuff, but I guess that strikes home to me in teaching American history when I talked about the reasons for the American Revolution, declaring independence from Britain. You know, we had that phrase, no taxation without representation. That comes down to the idea of you can't take my stuff without my permission. And it is tied to God's law. You know, thou shalt not steal. God supports that. Anyways, we'll move on. I think that it's not difficult to comprehend. The next commandment is you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. We could simplify that to don't lie. Be truthful. You know, bearing false witness sounds like it's referring to testimony in court. And, of course, perjury. It's funny, in the United States, it's not against the law to lie, which is kind of sad. Except unless you're in court under oath, and then it's considered perjury, and that is a punishable offense. But God's law says, no, it's not okay to lie anytime. You know, it doesn't matter, and that includes white lies. No, that's not okay. Falsifying your tax returns, you know, that's lying. You know, there's all kinds of things that we might be tempted to do, but it's not just a matter of making a bald-faced lie to someone's face. You know, now, I want to be careful because there are times where you just keep your mouth shut so that you don't say a lie. But, you know, you're in danger. There's times when withholding information accomplishes the same thing, and we want to be careful about that as well. But, well, I think, I talked about how my grandma, she reached that age where she knew she could say what she wanted and it'd be okay, or she had the right to say things. But she would sometimes point to this. I remember Well, she said something pretty disparaging about somebody that came into her doctor's office. And Sue said, Grandma, you shouldn't say that. She said, well, I can't lie. I have to tell the truth. She said, no, Grandma, you can just keep your mouth shut. You don't have to just say whatever enters your mind. So we want to keep that in mind as well. Okay, and then the last commandment in verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. I'm going to stop there because I believe this is one commandment against coveting, and it goes on to talk about your neighbor's male servant or female servant, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Coveting is about controlling your thoughts. And I would say it benefits you more than anyone else. Or if I'm looking in the mirror, me. Me, if I'm coveting something, I'm not hurting the person that I'm coveting from unless I take action and steal. But I am hurting myself long before. I mentioned earlier, though, that the Catholic Church, when it listed the Ten Commandments, it breaks this down into two. It would say that don't covet your neighbor's house is commandment number 9, and don't covet your neighbor's wife is commandment number 10. And they do that to keep the number at 10 when they combine 1 and 2, which we believe is improper. Interestingly, one reason that we can use to support that it is indeed one commandment is where they're given a second time in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 21, it reverses the order of wife and house. So here it says, don't covet your neighbor's house, then don't covet your neighbor's wife. In Deuteronomy, it says, don't covet your neighbor's wife, and don't covet your neighbor's house. Which, if they are two separate commandments, it's the one time that God would have been switching the order and going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 9, which, you know, I don't think that's the case. Instead, what we want to do is we want to think of what it says in Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 6. And there's no reason you would automatically know what that says. Ecclesiastes 4, 6 is where Solomon said, better is a handful with quietness than both full with toil and grasping. Which the toil and grasping implies, it's not exactly covetous, but it's like, I got to get more. I'm going to strive. I'm going to be torn up until I get more. And he says, except having half as much with peace of mind, that's much better. And that avoids covetousness. Before we move on, let me add one other comment on coveting. Paul, the Apostle Paul, said something interesting in the book of Colossians. Colossians 3 and verse 5. In Colossians 3, 5, it says, covetousness is idolatry. Why would you say covetousness is idolatry? Or why would he say that? Thoughts, Nate?
You're always thinking about it, you're always pursuing it, so it's always on your mind, and therefore putting it first before God.
Okay, yeah, so the it, you mean whatever it is you're coveting. Yeah, so basically you're letting something come before God, you're focusing on that. And I think that's, I can't get the words out today. That's completely true, but noting it here makes a nice little loop, because then it's tying covetousness to idolatry, which takes us back to the beginning of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, and don't make any graven images. So, you know, they are all integral to each other. Basically, have a godly mindset, try to be like him, and you'll be obeying all the laws. If you're not, you know, obviously, things aren't going so good. I want to continue. So in my version of the Ten Commandments, these are indented to show that this is something unique and special. This is God speaking himself. And since God was speaking, it was loud. It was powerful. And in verse 18, it says, the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And guess what they did? When the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. I'm sure as this is going, they're probably backing up. You know, maybe some of them turn around and ran. I referenced Hebrews 12, verse 21. Matter of fact, well, no, I won't turn there, but it said even Moses was shaking and was terrified. So Moses wrote that down somewhere besides here, but okay, Moses is scared and he talks to God all the time. So the people don't want this to happen anymore. Verse 19, they said to Moses, will you speak with us? Then we'll hear, but don't let God speak to us, lest we die. This is God keeps talking to us, we're going to die. Moses, you go talk to him and come back and tell us what he said. Moses said to the people, don't fear. God has come to test you so that you may fear. His fear may be before you so that you may not sin. So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. What it doesn't say here, actually I'm going to flip over to Deuteronomy 18. There's a detail that Moses adds later that for some reason he didn't write here. Deuteronomy 18, beginning in verse 16. He's nearly 40 years later reminding the younger generation of exactly what we're reading about here. It says, according to all that you desired from the Lord your God in Horeb in the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear the voice of the Lord my God, or let me see this great fire, lest I die. And the Lord said to me, what they've spoken is good. So he didn't include it in Exodus, but here we see God was okay with that. He said, yeah, what they said is good. I'll raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brethren. I'll put my words in his mouth and he'll speak to them. That ties back to verse 15, kind of leads up to this, where it says, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst. And we've made the point that the New Testament shows that that is a reference to Jesus Christ as a messianic prophecy. But I think at the same time, that doesn't lessen that it explains how God would communicate with human beings through most of history. Because they only came and spoke to a nation once. I'm doing this, but it's once. Okay, he spoke from them out in the one time, and the people were scared to death, and they probably wet their pants and fell all over each other running away. It's a terrible, scary thing. And they're saying, Moses, don't let God talk to us anymore. And God said, yeah, that's fine, I get it. You know, I did this for a purpose, I made my point. From now on, I'll raise up a prophet like you. For now, Moses, it is you. I'm going to tell you, you tell them. But we could see going forward into the future, God would speak to a prophet, or in some cases a prophetess, to send the message. And of course, like the book of Hebrews says, in the latter times he spoke through his son. I think, am I right? Is that how the book of Hebrews begins? Yes? Yeah, Hebrews 1:1, God who at various times and in various ways spake in time past to the fathers by the prophets, and these has in these last days spoken to us by his Son. So we see, the reason I'm spending enough time on this is it's a principle, it makes us understand why God has been doing what he has, or at least that he had a particular plan. You know, it wasn't that he was calling and nobody thought to answer the phone. It's like, no, I'm not going to talk to them in person. I'll call an individual, a prophet, and he'll spread the word. So getting back to there, that's where we are with this. So we get back to Exodus 20, verse 21. The people stood afar off, but Moses drew near. Then the Lord said to Moses, okay, let me start filling you in on some other stuff. Thus you'll say to the children of Israel, you've seen that I talked with you from heaven. You shall not make anything to be with me. Gods of silver or gods of gold you shall not make for yourselves. So that's harkening back to the Ten Commandments, a sort of reminder. Hey, you see, I'm not like that. You can't represent me with, you know, visual representation. Don't think that any of these other things that people call gods are gods. They're not. He goes on, he says, an altar of earth you'll make for me, and you'll make sacrifice on it. Your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and oxen, and every place where I record my name, I'll come to you. And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall build it, you shall not build it of hewn stone. Hewn means like shaped stone. But he says instead, you'll use just stones the way they're found in nature. For if you use your tool on it, you've profaned it. Let me make a point here. The word altars we get in English comes from, I believe, the Latin word altus, A-L-T-U-S, which means high or elevated. So the word altar in English, it means an elevation. But that's not the Hebrew word. The Hebrew word is mizbach, which it means a place of worship or sacrifice. And the transliteration I have is M-I-Z-B-A-C-H, and it means place for sacrifice. What I'm getting at, the Hebrew word does not imply elevation. So God doesn't require elevation for sacrifice. He doesn't necessarily forbid it, but one thing he'll say in verse 26, don't go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed on it. Which seems we're basically, I don't know, if you've ever followed somebody up steps and they're wearing too short a skirt, you get the, you know, it's not hard to explain what he's getting at there. But we'll see in representations later of the tabernacle and the altar out front, you'll see they show a ramp going up to it instead of steps, because God specifically said, that's the way I want it. I was going to add, the pagan religions around Israel, those people would tend to worship on hilltops, both in the time of Moses and for centuries after. And later we'll see other religions will build very high, impressive buildings. If you've been to Europe and visited a cathedral, every time I go in, I go, wow, that's it is impressive. It's really cool. God doesn't forbid building tall buildings, but he says you don't need to do that to represent me. He said, I made everything. You can look at a mountain. You can look up at the clouds. That shows how great I am. So God isn't worried about these physical things to represent him. I'm pausing there. I'm at the end of a chapter. Any questions? Okay, because we're about to move into three chapters that are described as the judgments. And the reason they're called the judgments is because here in chapter 21, verse 1, it says, now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. So we didn't have to make it up. It is separate from the Ten Commandments, but it's clear that it's based upon them. Okay, but the Ten Commandments, God spoke for everyone to hear, and he would write them on tables of stone. But God did speak these words to Moses to carry on. But you can make a note in Deuteronomy 5, verse 22. Remember, Deuteronomy 5 is the other place that lists the Ten Commandments. But there it says, after God spoke the Ten Commandments, he added no more. And you might say, well, what do you mean he added no more? Because here he's about to give Moses three chapters worth of more. Well, he didn't add more of the Ten Commandments. That kind of indicates that the Ten Commandments are in a different category than some of these other things. The Ten Commandments are absolutely what we would call a timeless spiritual law. Now, they apply to all people at all time. And they're summarized by the two great commandments that Jesus Christ said. Love the Lord your God with, I would say, your all your might, all your strength, all your mind. And the second, love your neighbor as yourself. And I've got a reference for that, Matthew 22, verses 37 to 39. Okay, as again, that's the summarizing, and you could say both of those are represented simply by the word love. And 1 John 4:8 reminds us that God is love. God's nature of love is expressed through love God. People should love him because he's supreme. Love your neighbor as yourself. And then the Ten Commandments are a further expression of how to do that. And we can make the case there are further breakdowns and expressions of how to do that. I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying the Ten Commandments are the only enduring spiritual laws. I believe there are others. But they're the ones that it's the most clear cut. There's no doubt that these are. Some others will say, well, is this something for a specific time and place, or is it for all time? And you kind of have to explore and make a case. But with these, it's very clear. But we believe all of these are based on timeless spiritual principles. And I want to make that case as we go into the judgments. Because another way to consider these judgments in Exodus 21 through 23 is to look at them as somewhat of a what we would call a civil law for the nation of Israel. A law for a specific political body that makes up this group of people that will be in a certain space, which doesn't necessarily in every case apply to other people that aren't there. And a nation has an authority to punish crime, for instance. And when I say a nation has the authority to do that, that implies who does not have that authority, who or what. Did you say individuals? Okay, individuals do not. What beyond individuals? But we could say certain institutions or organizations don't necessarily have that power. And one that we want to be very clear does not is a church. We're not a nation here gathered as God's people. We are a church. So we don't have the power or authority to exercise the punishments that are described here. We should, as individuals and as a church, strive to live by the principles espoused here. And there's principles underlying all of these that are valid, but some of the specifics may not apply because the situation doesn't exist anymore. And we try to be clear on those as we go. But one of the things we'll get at, matter of fact, you'll see several crimes that are designated for capital punishment. And we might want to avoid doing those things, but, you know, Mr. Myers isn't going to call anybody up to the front on the Sabbath and say, okay, you broke this law, so sorry, we have to stone you. We don't do that. Okay. I guess I'm making that case. I want it to be clear, but it's pretty simple. It's not a difficult to understand concept. I will add, later we're going to read a lot of things that are part of what we call the ritual law, or we say sacrificial law, describing procedures for a physical nation to worship God. And God gave them to a physical people who did not have His Holy Spirit. And so in most of those things, we don't do. You know, you don't get a lamb and slash its throat and pull out the fat of the kidneys and do a certain... We don't have to do that, which I'm thankful for, because the little experience I had butchering meat told me that's not fun. I like to eat meat, but I don't like to have to cut up a carcass. Okay, so we can say it's a separate code of law. And there's overlapping things. One of the reasons I want to mention that, matter of fact, I'm going to turn back to Jeremiah 7. We've covered this not long ago in Major Prophets class. Jeremiah 7, verse 22. Jeremiah 7, 22, God says, I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I've commanded you that it may be well with you. And that's, we read that back in Exodus 19, God told Moses, go tell the people, this is my proposal. Obey me, I'll be your God, you'll be my special people. And then he spoke the Ten Commandments. And we're going to go through all these judgments, and you know what we're not going to find? Sacrifices. We'll see sacrifices referenced, but the sacrifices are going to be added after the covenant is entered into, showing that it's not unimportant, but it's not part of the covenant they made with God. Matter of fact, we could I'll also read Galatians 3 and verse 19 that helps support that idea. Galatians 3:19. What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come. So this is a case where some people say the law, well, that's the Ten Commandments. I would make the case that the law that Paul is referring to there specifically is the ritual law that was added because of transgressions, but wasn't part of the original covenant. So let's move on. Unless there are any questions, concerns? Yes, Matt?
Are you getting at, when we get to Exodus 24, talking about the, I think it's called the Book of the Covenant, that was described as a Book of the Covenant, was the original covenant? And because from that point on, we no longer see referred to the Book of the Covenant, but the Book of the Law, which includes all the additional judgments and statutes.
Yeah, we'll see some of those terms are used interchangeably, but most scholars seem to think the Book of the Covenant is going to include these next three chapters. Because we'll get to the end of those, and then we'll see the covenant ratified through a ceremonial sacrifice and such. So in the book means, the word book is derived, it really meant a scroll that Moses wrote this on, whereas the Ten Commandments were written on stone. Probably Moses wrote the Ten Commandments on the scroll too, because it was probably long enough to... So, but then the ritual sacrifices seem to be a separate thing. Is that... I'm not sure if I answered your question or if I... I'm not trying to be a politician here. Okay. So, and maybe it'll be more clear as we go on. So let's get into some of these judgments though. We get verses 2 through 6 deal with Hebrew slavery. Okay, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he'll serve 6 years, and in the seventh he'll go out free and pay nothing. Okay, if he comes in by himself, he'll go out by himself. If he came in married, his wife will go out with him. If his master gave him a wife, and she bore him sons or daughters, the wife and the children belong to the master, and the guy can go out without them. If the servant plainly says, I love my master and my wife and children, I choose to not go out free. I reworded that, but that's what it means. He's saying, I'm making this choice, and his master will bring him to the judges. So basically, this has to be a I'm not sure a ceremony, but a legal action for this guy to continue in slavery at his choice. So the judges determine that this is the case, and the master will pierce his ear with an awl, and he'll serve him forever. Okay, so we can see God permitted a form of slavery in ancient Israel. And we'll see regulations show it was quite different than what we're presented as part of American history, you know, which was based on racism and economics and a lot of things. I've said before, I think this slavery appears to be much more of what we would consider indentured servitude. Oh, and one of the things I want to note here, because I think this is partly an answer to a number of things that come up that we don't do as Christians or think we should not do, but we see regulations about them. One of the things here is God does not say you have to have slaves. He's not saying go out and make slaves in Israel. He's basically taking something that existed and making regulations about it so that it's not misused or misused to an extreme. I would apply the same later to polygamy. God never says you should have more than one wife, but he'll make regulations that for if they did, how to regulate it. How did a person lose his freedom, even though it's temporary? So 6 years, and the seventh, you go out free. I'll note, depending on the language, in some places it makes it look like you go out at the end of the seventh year. More places seem like you serve six, and at the beginning of the seventh, you go free. But there's room, it could be interpreted either way. You know, one reason you could end up in this temporary slavery is poverty. Not that you're made a slave just because you're poor, but you could say, hey, I got no way to support myself, I'll sell myself into slavery. And the head of a family could sell others. We'll see in verse 7 that he could sell his daughter into slavery. And there's some more regulations about that. Okay, so if you just, you're not going to make it, there's no Social Security office or welfare office to go sign up for benefits. You go to the village, the gate of the square to the judges and say, hey, I need to become someone's servant. And that could be arranged. Another one is for debt. If you've got a debt that you can't pay, a man could be sold to pay the debt. Okay, and that's closely related. The three things I've got are poverty, debt, and the third one is crime. A person commits a crime and the punishment involves a type of restitution, but he doesn't have the means to make the restitution. He could be sold instead. Matter of fact, you see that across the page in chapter 22, verse 3. Chapter 22, verse 3, the latter part of the verse says, he should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Okay, notice, as I said, we could relate this almost to accomplish what our modern bankruptcy laws are meant to do. Someone gets in a situation where they can't survive, we've got a means to erase debt. There, the system seems, and I'm saying seems because this isn't spelled out, but it seems it was meant to help rehabilitate people who made bad financial decisions. Because imagine a person gets in this situation many times because he just isn't managing his affairs well. Maybe he's never been taught good use of money and resources. So what happens is he ends up being sold. Who has the money to buy that person? Well, maybe someone who does know how to manage his affairs and does know how to manage his resources. So if I'm just inept at running a farm and paying my bills, but Nate is really good at it, I might be sold. I come to work for Nate, and I can watch him and go, oh, that's how to properly run a farm and pay your bills. And over the course of 6 years, I might get an education in how to do it, and then I'm going to be freed, and hopefully that'll be the only time I go in. Matter of fact, you might make a note to reference Deuteronomy 15. Deuteronomy 15, verses 12 to 14, adds to this regulation that when the service is finished, the master doesn't just say, here's the door, don't let it hit you on the way out. He has to provide the departing servant with supplies and equipment. So I've been working for Nate here for 6 years. Now my term is done. He's got to give me like a plow and a hoe and a supply of seed so I can go out to my land and hopefully I can run it at a profit from now on. So as I said, this whole system is to try to take people who've gotten themselves into a bad way and raise them out of it through education and supplies. Yes, Julia?
What was the verse again?
That was Deuteronomy 15, verses 12 to 14. But one thing we see here is the servant has the choice if he wants to stay with the master. He can say, I don't want to go free. I want to stay. But we have seen if he does that, you know, there's restrictions. You can't build a family while you're in slavery. Like, you belong to someone else, you're restricted. The master, and I'm using Nate here, Nate can give me a wife, you know, and I can choose to have children, but if I make that choice, they belong to him, not to me, until I go free. Or I can say, I love working for Nate so much, here, put a hole in my ear, I want to stay. Nate's looking sour at this, he doesn't want me for a slave. But that's okay, I'm not planning on that happening anyways. Okay, so we move on now in verse 7. If a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. So, not a limited term. But we'll see why soon. It says, if she does not please her master who has betrothed her to himself, he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people. And if he's betrothed her to his son, he'll deal with her according to the custom of daughters. So this is saying with a female slave, if she's not already married, it's basically taking her on as a type of wife, perhaps a concubine. Which, you know, that seems distasteful to me. I'm not recommending, again, God's not saying this is the system I want to have happen. I think he's taking a custom that had been in practice and putting regulations on it. And in some ways for protection. Notice in verse 10, if he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. So if a man has more than one wife, he's required to provide for all of them equally. Okay, then the same food, the same amount of clothing, and the same marriage rights, which marriage rights we would imply includes, you know, time in bed, but I would say also time and attention. So all of these are required. You can't have a favorite and treat the other like a servant. And again, I'll add, you know, people, we always wonder, why would God allow polygamy? Because it seems evident by what we see in Scripture and what Christ would later see. Christ later said, in the beginning, it was not meant, you know, he describes the creation of marriage, you know, and God didn't intend divorce, he didn't intend polygamy, but it did exist, so God made rules for it. You know, he never commanded anybody to do it. You know, there's no command saying you have to take a second or third wife, but he put in rules to make it work better. Similarly, he never made a rule that say you have to steal, but there are regulations of what to do if someone does. That makes sense? And to me, that's still not a fully satisfying answer about polygamy. And I wish the Bible said more so we could answer all those questions. But in our modern era in the church, with our understanding of the new covenant and with the Holy Spirit, we believe that polygamy just shouldn't exist, not that we make the best of it if it is. So we treat it differently now. Okay, let's move on. Verse 12, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. Okay, murder is a capital offense. You strike a person and it kills him, the punishment is death. But there's a however in verse 13. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, I'll appoint a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you'll take him from my altar that he may die. This is showing that an accidental killing was not punishable by capital offense. And when it says God delivered him, I think that was an idiom of saying happenstance. Later on, there's a case where God describes if you're out in the forest and you're chopping down a tree and the axe head flies off and accidentally kills someone, well, that was an accident. But the guy, you know, the brother of the guy who got killed might not see it that way and he comes after you. And of course, we'll have the cities of refuge system set up. That's first referenced in Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19, verses 1 through 13, lays that out as they're about to enter the promised land. And in class, you've already covered it from the opposite side of when they entered the promised land. So in the book of Joshua, you saw cities of refuge set apart. I'm pretty sure Mr. Myers discusses that. We'll cover it a little bit more when we get to Deuteronomy. So I'll just say it in passing here. The idea is intentional murder is punishable by death. Accidental killing is not punishable by death. Verse 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Wow. Oh, matter of fact, well, I skipped ahead. I wanted to go do verse 15. He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And I was going to go down to 17. So either striking or cursing a person's parents is a capital offense. I would say that's a very strong enforcement of the command to honor your father and your mother. I'm glad that we haven't enforced that in modern times. I had been known to say some disrespectful things to my mother when I was younger, and glad I was allowed time to repent. Okay, verse 16. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he's found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. Okay, kidnapping is a capital offense. So, I'm going to say, don't kidnap. I don't think that's something any of us are inclined to do. And if we are, well, the laws of this nation aren't as strict, but it's still punished pretty severely, I believe. Okay, verse 18 and 19. If men contend with each other and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist and he dies, or he doesn't die but is confined to his bed, and if he rises again and walks outside with a staff, he who struck him will be acquitted. He'll only pay for the loss of his time and provide for him to be healed. So here, you know, if one person injures another without killing him and he can recover, there's still a liability. You know, the responsible person has to pay the financial consequences. I would tie this to what we'll see much more in the next chapter is what the principle of making restitution. Okay, matter of fact, there's two big principles that tend to underlie a lot of these laws, and one is restitution. Without looking at a Webster's, say, how would we define making restitution? What does that mean? Somebody help me. Nathan.
Does it mean making right or...
Okay, we use the term make it right or make it good. But so I can say, well, what does that mean? Michelle?
We often use it in civil law for like when you broke something or property or something, you try to restitute something to what it was originally.
Okay, I forgot you were studying law. Now, restore things to the way they were. You break something, you either cause it to be fixed or you replace it with something as good. Does that fit with what you're saying? So in this case, a person is broken or injured and you pay to basically provide their support until things are the way they were. Now, again, I jumped ahead, but we'll see this come up many times later. The other principle I want to get to is coming up soon, but it's time for us to take a break.